we should be aware that this event is a part of a statewide mobilization to save the life of Kevin Cooper. So up and down the state of California, people are gathering, as we gather this evening, to reflect on what we might do to save his life and to forward the campaign to abolish the death penalty. And it's especially important to do this work here in California. What happens here will have an impact not only on this state, but because we live in the state that has the largest death row in the country, we can affect the future of capital punishment in the country and indeed in the world. I might remember that in the early 70s, when California abolished the death penalty in 1972, it led the way for the at least temporary abolition of capital punishment throughout the country. And I can say that I myself at that time faced three capital charges. And when California temporarily abolished the death penalty, I was able to be released on bail because those capital charges were non-bailable offenses. So thanks to that work, I stand here this evening. And so I would like to suggest, as others have done, that we reflect on the possible execution of Kevin Cooper, that we think about what we might do at this very last minute to prevent this execution, but that we also broaden our vision and think about strategies that might persuade larger numbers of people that this outmoded punishment, which has been rejected by most countries in the world, should finally be put to rest here as well. Let us remember, or let us take note of the fact that since the beginning of the year, this is only the second month, the beginning of the second month of the year, 8 people have been executed already. Now, it used to be the case that whenever an execution happened anywhere in the country, there was a great deal of media attention. Now it has become routine, a part of the normal routine. The majority of people who've been executed thus far this year have been in, guess, Texas, precisely, the state that produced the unelected president who gave us the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq and Homeland Security and the Patriot Act. Now, California now joins Ohio as the only 2 non-Southern states to conduct executions this year. It's important that we think about the meaning of the fact that the overwhelming majority of executions have always taken place and continue to take place in the South. Now, just a word about Schwarzenegger. I find it very difficult to say Governor Schwarzenegger. It makes me feel like that too. But he is the first governor since the death penalty was returned to the state to deny a clemency hearing to a death row inmate. You should know that Schwarzenegger refused to grant clemency, but he also refused to convene a hearing, which has happened in every other case. I mean, even Pete Wilson held public clemency hearings. Now, this should expel hopes, because I know that there are people who still believe that somehow or another, Schwarzenegger, because he is, I don't know what, an actor, the Terminator, whatever, that there is some hope that, I've heard people say that because he's a Republican, he's not facing the same kinds of pressures that Gray Davis faced. That there may be a little more flexibility there, and even people have even said that perhaps his wife, Maria Shriver, will be able to persuade him to stand up against the death penalty. But I think we need to expel all such hopes from our imagination. Schwarzenegger based his decision to let the execution date stand on what he described as the excessively cruel character of the violence visited upon the four people who died and the one survivor in the case for which Kevin Cooper was convicted. Now, I want to, for a few minutes, talk about the question of innocence. The question of innocence. Because the major debate around the Kevin Cooper case revolves around that issue. And certainly, as has been pointed out before, the most dramatic developments in the around the issue of capital punishment in recent times have revolved around this question of innocence. The 112 people who have been exonerated, 112 out of approximately 3,500. The most recent person to be exonerated was Nicholas James Yarris, who had been on death row for many years in Pennsylvania. He became the 10th person to be exonerated from death row in 2003. That was on December 9th, based on DNA. Now, the question I want to ask is whether we can expect all inhabitants of death rows across the country to turn out, quote, innocent. And even those who did not commit the crime with which they are charged remain guilty before the law, unless there is what is called compelling evidence of their innocence. Actual innocence is a category that has developed alongside other categories of innocence. There is a legal category called innocent of the death penalty, or innocent of death. This is an extremely limited construction of innocence, of course. This actual innocence excludes claims of self-defense. It's often referred to as real or factual innocence. Moreover, the claim of innocence follows conviction, right? So that the claim of innocence can only be made as a counterclaim to legal guilt. In other words, innocence is precisely produced by findings of guilt in conjunction with irrefutable evidence of the erroneousness of those findings. Now, I'm not so much interested in the legal implications of actual innocence, I'm not challenging all of the remarkable work that has been done recently that has led to the exonerations of 112 people. But I think it might be important to think about the popular ideological framework this focus on innocence establishes. I think it might be important to ask ourselves why, in order to feel comfortable in our opposition to the death penalty, particularly in specific cases, we have to immediately move toward that question of innocence. And at the same time, in doing that, we are, by implication, arguing, well, The guilty people, maybe they don't really deserve the death penalty, but they deserve the death penalty more than those who are innocent. Innocent, quote unquote. And as I said, lives have been saved by DNA evidence. But the fact is, many cases do not involve DNA at all. And the definition of actual innocence is so narrow that it involves some kind of scientifically verifiable evidence. Now, in this constricted and constricting framework for death penalty opposition, which constructs innocence as the dominant grounds for release from what is the highest penalty, the abolition of the death penalty per se is, and this is another problem I'm trying to point out, is only conceivable as a strategy of proposing a new capital penalty. And what is that new capital penalty? Life without possibility of parole, which strangely recapitulates the history of the prison as alternative to capital and corporal punishment. So we're talking about permanent civil death, life without possibility of parole, permanent civil death, which is imagined as the alternative to corporeal death, that is to say, life without parole as the proper equivalent to death, which then requires the permanence of the institution of the prison and becomes a major barrier to the development of popular ideas about the possible abolition of the prison. So I'm suggesting that as you think about death penalty abolitionism, you might also want to think about prison abolitionism. I'm suggesting that as you think about the reasons why we need to rid this, our social landscape of the death penalty, you think about the death penalty as an inheritance of slavery. And not only an inheritance of slavery, but as a form of punishment which reminds us that slavery is still with us. And why do I say that? Just very briefly, I just want to take 2 minutes. I know I'm about, I don't even know what time I started. What time did I start? Okay, I'm just going to try to explain this very briefly. And my students, I see many of my students here. We can talk about this later in class. The death penalty was slated to be abolished, basically, with the emergence of the prison around the time of the American Revolution, right? The prison was supposed to be the alternative to death and horrendous corporeal punishment. What happened, however, was that it was abolished for virtually all offenses other than murder for white people. And as a matter of fact, slavery became a receptacle that kept the death penalty alive. In the state of Virginia, at one point, as Frederick Douglass pointed out, a white man could receive death for only one crime, but a slave could receive death for some 70 different offenses. And I don't have time to go into the way in which capital punishment evolved, but I want to suggest that you think about the racism inherent in the death penalty, not only in terms of the people who are put to death by the state, not only in terms of the victims of those who are put to death, but also in terms of its institutional character as embodying in slavery, regardless of the particular person whom it might affect. So it means that it's racist regardless of who sits on death row. It means that white people who receive the death penalty are also affected by this racism that these structures of racism that retain structures of slavery. Does that make any sense? Okay. So what I want to say is Kevin Cooper may well be innocent, but many of us must claim that this is not the only reason he should not be put to death. We are opposed to capital punishment because it is racist, because it is outmoded, because it is wrong, because it is wrong. Even in the face of what unfortunately appears to be certainty that Kevin Cooper will be executed, we need to fight back. So let us unleash on the governor's offices a massive torrent of telephone calls, telegrams, emails, letters. Let us do whatever we can at this late date to save the life of Kevin Cooper. And should he be executed on February 10th, do not stop. Continue to fight in his name.